All right, welcome to the Erie Music History Podcast. I'm Chip Shell, your host, and my guest today is calling in from Australia. So it is 7 a.m. my time, about 9 p.m., 9:30 p.m. his time. He has two Emmy Awards for work that he did in the 1980s on the TV show Santa Barbara. He has scored over 1,500 hours of original music for broadcast TV series, films, and documentaries. And in the mid-1970s, he moved to L.A., and became a top session guitarist, working with artists such as Barry Manilow, Minnie Riperton, Tina Marie, and the group that drew him away from Erie when he was just 19, the Letterman. So welcome to the podcast, Art Phillips.
Well, thank you very much. Very honored to be here. Fantastic. 9 p.m., I'm having my glass of vino.
All right. That's not a small glass either. That's good. Good. That's the way to do it. Art, your resume and experience is extensive. I didn't even mention your production company, 101 Music, that you still run today. We'll get to that. We'll get to a lot of other stuff. First, I should say thank you to your cousin and my musical buddy, Angelo Phillips, for connecting us. He's a great guy, great musician, big supporter of this podcast, and I'm actually going to see him play tonight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So before you started traveling the world, playing for famous musicians, running your own company. Let's tell the story of your days back here in Erie. You grew up on Cold Spring Drive, which is a short little street above 26th Street near World of Music. Your dad was a guitarist. Tell us about your dad and how that impacted you.
Well, that was definitely it. I mean, my dad, just a great, great man, of course, an amazing musician, had such a feel for the guitar. He was really known for his rhythm playing more than anything. He was just solid as a rock, and, you know, it was like a percussion instrument. He was just an amazing guy. And when I grew up, you know, I mean, the day I was born, you know, from the day I was born, and probably even before that, you know, I had music vibrating all around me, of course, because my dad would practice guitar in the kitchen, you know, every night. And he had a group called the Strolling Venetians, and they worked around Erie at all the Italian restaurants, strolling from table to table. And his partner was either a mandolin player or an accordion player or another guitar player. Throughout my childhood, I saw, you know, him working with five or six different people as his co-partner, you know, because it changed periodically. So as a young child, I had music in the background all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I would be in my bedroom, you know, sleeping, and they would still be practicing because I would go to bed early, as I do nowadays at my age. And I grew up with Italian, you know, music, of course, and, you know, the old standards. That's really what it was. And because of my dad's passion for music, and he didn't do it full time for a living. He worked for the Erie School District, actually, in the maintenance department. But he played, I think, about four nights a week, as I recall, as a kid, you know?
Yeah, and I found lots of ads for, I mean, when I looked for your name, I found your dad's name a lot playing.
Did
at,
you?
You know, yeah. Playing at places like the Cesar Battista Club, the Blue Max Air in the airport. That was a restaurant there. Pernice's Italian restaurant. I mean, places that are not around and haven't been for a long time. And
no,
and
the Stagecoach Inn. And he used to play at the Erie Manicore Club. And a matter of fact, in my office and studio, I have all these photos on the wall of my dad from all those ads that you would have seen with him and his partner, John Narducci, and Renzo Armanini, the mandolin player, playing at all these different places. Just amazing. Yeah. And luckily for me, you know, I mean, I think I picked up the guitar probably when I was 5 or 6 years old, I think, you know, but I didn't really, really start playing, you know, until I was probably 7 or 8. That's still pretty young.
Yeah.
But I do remember, you know, we practiced every night together, and, you know, it was a slow learning curve. And my dad taught me. And then, my dad was well aware of the fact that he could only teach me what he could teach me, and that I should go to, you know, other proper teachers. And I started with a great player in Erie named Sam Rizzo, and that was my first guitar teacher. So I used to go to Markham School of Music on 11th or whatever street it was,
yeah.
You know, and and parade between parade and state, if I remember correctly.
Yep, right. Yeah.
You know, upstairs, downstairs. And, you know, we'd go downstairs in the morning and Sam Russo would teach me. And yeah, you know, just, you know, he was an amazing reader. So that really helped me in the early stages. Then my dad made sure that I had various people in my early life to teach me besides Sam Russo. I started learning with a great player named, I believe his name was Dick Honnard. And okay. Dick taught me a lot of really, really cool jazz voicings and stuff. And so between the three of them, and I had other teachers, I can't remember who they all were. It was just a really good upbringing. And funnily enough, I was probably 9, 10 years old. And I could taste what I really wanted to do, you know, yeah. And that's because of my dad and his father, Antonio DiFilippo, because our name is actually not Phillips. It's supposed to be DiFilippo. But when my grandpa, my dad's father, emigrated to Ellis Island, or at the States, it was 1901. He was only 7 years old, and they changed his name to Phillips. So my dad was born a Phillips. Sadly enough, this is sad to me because I think the Italian name is so important, but that's what happened. That's what happened. But my grandfather, Antonio DiFilippo, his name was Phillips, was a great mandolin player. And my mom's side of the family, who are from Lorain, Ohio, actually all four of my grandparents are all from the same little town in Italy, Montenero da Cocchiara in Molise.
Wow.
Vicino Abruzzo, about 15 miles from the bottom of Abruzzo, a place called Castel di Sangro. And if you cross the border and you drive up the little road up in the mountain, and it looks, you know, I mean, if you're up in a helicopter or an airplane, you can see a little town, which is the Spoon, and a little road going in and out, the same road. So it's called the Spoon of the Mountain, Montenero da Cocchiara. Yeah.
Have you been there?
So, yeah, well, about 6 or 7 times in the last 10 years.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just great. But so really came from strong, a musical background without actually realizing it, you know. And
what did your grandfather play? Did he play guitar too?
Mandolin. And my
mandolin.
Yeah. And my mom's father played guitar and also was a singer. So, and all of the brothers and sisters in that side of the family also were players where they played music. So, yeah, you know, I grew up with this and it was funny because my dad, you know, loved his record collection, and he had a lot of records of a gentleman named who was my hero, actually. And this was my, you know, I'll get chills when I say this, a guy named Tony Mottola from New York. Yeah.
And I know this story. I want to hear this story. This is great. Yeah. Like, how did you even get on his rate? First of all, you're 9 years old.
It's crazy.
And you you're not in one of those families where it's like, you need to play guitar. Like, you accepted, you liked playing guitar. So it wasn't like, you know, sit down and practice your piano. And I mean, am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, no, that's right. There was something, I don't know, but there was a real passion about it. But that's because I heard my dad playing every night of the week in the kitchen, you know, and there's this amazing acoustics that happens in the kitchen, you know. You know, but the whole house was always filled with guitar, you know. And my dad's guitar in particular had a great sound, and I actually have that guitar now. And I still play it. It's a 1942 Gibson L12. Anyway, but yeah, so when I was 9, and I should correct myself, maybe I wasn't 9, but I was probably 10. There was a record that my dad had of Tony Mottola. It was an album called Roman Guitar. I think it was a Roman Guitar 1. And there was a song on it that Tony was playing, a beautiful arrangement of a song called Anima e Cuore, which means, heart and soul in Italian. Yeah.
Okay.
And I just loved his style. You know, I mean, Mottola's style to me was like, that was it. And I think that's really one of my earlier influences. And I'll tell you later on in this podcast that I've gone back right to my roots. And a couple times a year, I do a solo guitar performance of all my own arrangements, but in that style, you know, in the a solo, you know, chordal melodic style that Mottola was doing.
I watched some of those videos that you did.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. The Christmas special. And people, we should say Tony Mottola, he was the guitarist for Perry Como. He played for Johnny Carson. I mean, this guy, he was legit. He was, you know, everywhere. He was, but yeah. At age nine, what year are we talking for you? I mean,
well, I was born in 55, so we're talking 1964.
Yeah. I mean, so crazy. Were you listening to the Beatles and other things at that time too?
Oh, yeah.
This was your influence because of the music in the household, the Italian sounding sound.
I guess so. There was something about that sound that really got to me. And of course, you know, of course I was listening to, you know, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles and all that stuff, but not the same way that I was listening to that. It was a different thing for me, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know how I guess I was 10 and a half. I actually wrote a letter to Tony Mottola. I wrote him a letter, right? And I have copies of all these letters, actually. It's
incredible. How do you even find out where to write Tony Mottola? This is the interesting part I wanted to hear from you is, you know,
I don't
what
know.
Does a 10-year-old write to a guitarist? What were you saying in those letters?
Yeah, I mean, I've often looked at those letters thinking, boy, I had a lot of guts, you know? I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I was a very shy kid, you know? Okay. You know, I was very shy and I still am, you know, and actually as a kid, actually, you know, like I'll be honest, I was so shy that I had a stuttering problem. So how in the world I was, you know, so, you know, about this is what I want. I could taste it. I could feel it. And I've developed this thing in my life from this experience and I call it FDP. And I teach entrepreneurship at a business school just for the fun of it, because I talk about my business and success and how you do stuff. And FDP to me stands for focus, determination, and perseverance. And that's what must have done it for me. I don't know where I got it from, but I did. Anyway, so I wrote Tony and I just said, look, you know, I mean, the first letter I wrote was, you know, I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania, you know, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And my dad has his records and I love the song Anima Accorda. And I was wondering, could you send me your arrangement of it? Oh, that's wow. What I asked him for, right? You know, I mean, anyway.
Do your folks back. Know that you're sending this letter?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
they did. Right. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, I wrote it to the record company he was with at the time, Command Performances. It then changed to Project 3 Records a few years later. I know this because we wrote back and forth and I must have 20 letters and it's just amazing. Anyway, he wrote to me and said, look, you know, I'm sure you're going to do fine in your career. You know, hello, I was 9, 10 years old. He didn't even know. And, you know, I can't send it to you because it's in copyright. And, you know, but the way that I used to do it, I used to slow down the 33 records to half speed and, you know, it would be down a octave. And he said, that's how I learned. That's what I recommend you doing. So I did, you know, I pulled everything down to 16 and a third, whatever it is. And, you know, you hear boom, 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 and you'll learn. That's how you learn. And that's what I did for years. And we kept writing back and forth. And he was very lovely and kept writing back to me. And then I called him on the phone a couple of years later. We, you know, I was 15 or 16 and we would talk.
Wow.
And, I know it's crazy. And you know,
were you talking about always like music and, you know, the songs that he played and how he played them?
Yeah.
The techniques.
You know, I mean, I would
like
just
that.
Ask him stuff and I would always tell him, you know, this is what I want to do for a living. What can you, you know, I was 13 or 14 and I went to, the local place where you buy, you know, great records. And I can't remember the name of the place that it was on 8th Street, but I bought a reel-to-reel tape recorder, you know?
Okay.
And I would practice and record and I created an album. I wish I had a photo of it and I send it to him and it was an album on a, you know, on a quarter inch tape, you know, 70s, you know, and I had artwork on it and everything. And I sent it to him and he came back and critiqued it. And, you know, I was probably 14 or 15, just nuts. The whole thing is nuts. And Chip, I got to tell you, I finally met him in real life, you know, and
I was going to ask.
It was the highlight of my life. And I was working with Barry Manilow and I invited him to the concert and he came with his wife and it was just incredible. And I think he was really quite happy and proud to see that this kid, you know,
sure.
You know, I did this and that. And then, but I remember the day before the concert that he came to the concert in New York, he invited me to a recording session. And I went to this recording session, you know, and I met all the guys that, you know, were on all those albums, like Bob Haggard on bass, and you know, and Vinnie Bell on guitar, you know, and him, and I sat there, you know, sort of in the session, watched these guys play, and it was like, it was the weirdest thing for me. I couldn't even talk.
I
couldn't speak. I couldn't even communicate with this guy, Tony Mottola. He was like my hero. Was like,
yeah.
And I'm like 20 something years old, you know.
I was going to say, how old was he? How much older was he than you?
Well, he and my dad were the same age. They were both born in 1918. And this would have been I was with Manilow in 1982, 83, 84. So it was probably 83.
Okay.
So I would have been, 20. Oh, no, hang on. I would have been about 26 years old, and I couldn't speak. I couldn't
speak. Well, eventually, like I mentioned earlier, you know, the Letterman play a big part in you leaving Erie, but Mottola is involved in that story too. So it's 74, the Letterman play in Erie, I think at Gannon maybe. How do you go talk to their arranger? I mean, how did that even transpire?
Yeah, well, I was with my sister and her husband at the time. I don't know what year this was. I think I was in ninth grade.
Okay.
I think I was in ninth grade, possibly 10th, but I think I was probably ninth. And I, you know, we went to this concert at Gannon College, and it was a Letterman, and I was just in awe. Well, because that's what I wanted to do. I knew this is what I wanted to do for a living.
Yeah.
And I asked my sister if we could stay after the concert just a little bit as all the people went, because I wanted to go talk to the guy who was the conductor, you know, up on the stage. And she said, of course, I'm sure, you know. And my sister has a big part of this, actually, you know, I have to say, and she'll be listening to this at some point, but I honestly have to say, she is such a major force in my career without actually really knowing it, for two reasons. We stayed that night, and she said, of course, go. And Vince Morton, who was the piano player, the keyboard player, after the concert, came back up to pack up the music and all the stuff. And I walked up on stage, and I had a business card.
Wow.
I had a business card. Yeah, it said Art Phillips Guitar. And I still have this card because it's a classic, you know? And anyway, so I spoke to him, and I don't know how I did, because I was very shy and I stuttered, and, you know, I actually developed this terrible stutter in first grade because the teacher at the Catholic school didn't recognize that I had a bit of a deficiency in terms of, you know, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And I found ways of camouflaging it my whole early life. I'm totally fine now. But this is true. And anyway, I don't know how I had the guts to get up to him and talk, but I did. And you know, we talked for about 2-3 minutes, and I passed him my card, and he gave me his. Big mistake.
Wait, how old are you again?
I'm in ninth grade.
Yeah, you're in ninth grade. You hand him your card. Okay,
yeah,
I love this.
Yeah. And I put his card in my wallet, and I said, "This is what I want to do." And you know, and he said, "Oh, you know, well, you know, I mean, it's a great career. What you should do is learn as much as you can and go to college and all this stuff." Yeah. So I, you know, so anyway. That was that. And I go through 10th, 11th, 12th grade, and I'm working with people like Ron Segi in town, you know, in his band. And, you know, I'm his arranger and guitar player.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too. Yeah,
it was a great band with Derf Hopsinger on bass, and Rick Cass on drums. And
they're part of that group that I told you about that I have as the house band each month.
Okay. Oh, right.
They're part of that group. Yeah.
Oh, well. Well. Yeah. You know, these memories are so solid. But and anyway, we, you know, it was a great upbringing, and I learned well from people like Ron, you know, who's a real pro, and all the other guys, and you know,
we'll go back for a second. So you're at this. You hand your card to this guy, and
you're
in ninth grade or whatever it is, but you now have been taking lessons from people for a while, but you start teaching at Osiki's for a little bit, don't you?
Well, that's I forgot about that. I actually taught at Osiki's. I was quite young. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I wondered.
Yeah. And I taught on, I think it was on Parade Street. Yeah. And how I got that gig was Mike D'Amico. He was a guitar player, and he worked there, and he was a great guitar player. And I sort of got to know each other. I was a kid, and he liked me, and a position came up, and he asked me if I wanted to teach, and I said, yeah, you know. And that, so after high school, I would drive over there and teach until 8 o'clock at night, you know?
Wow. Did you play guitar in school, like in bands or anything, or jazz bands or?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Most certainly. At Academy High School, I was supposed to go to Strong Vincent, but they changed the boundaries a week before I was going to high school. And I ended up going to Academy, which I didn't want to go to, but I'm so glad I did because that experience was sensational. Bill Berger was the band oh, yeah. instructor, and I was in his jazz band, and yeah, that was a great experience. So that really pulled me up a lot sure. as well.
Yeah. You graduated 73, you said?
Or, I did, yeah.
There were some other musicians in that school at the time too, I think, that did well. Who were some of your buddies that you remember?
A lot. Yeah. Oh, well, Mike Applebaum, he's in Italy now, and he's a brilliant, trumpet player. He left a bit early. I don't think he graduated with us. He ended up going to Rochester, New York or something. But of course, there was a lot of musicians in that school, you know, and yeah. I'm very good friends with a lot from Strong Vincent too, like Dan McNamara. You know, Dan is a really
I Dan on the podcast. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually Dan did an album for me for my company 101 Music, because I have a music a library production company.
Yeah.
And that album he did three, all percussion, and it's doing really, really well. So Dan's a great talent. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a great guy. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. He was a fun interview too. Okay, so we haven't even got you being graduated yet, but I mean, we're getting close, and you've got this relationship with Mottola, the Letterman guy. You make this connection with him, you hand him your card, and then what transpires?
Okay, so 3 years later, I graduate high school, and I'm going to Berklee School of Music, but I never got there, right?
Okay.
Because I'm at my sister's house one night with my girlfriend and we're talking, and my sister says, so what are you going to do? I said, yeah, well, I'm going to go to Berklee, you know? And she said, that's great. You know, why don't you try and get a job with like the Letterman or something? You know, she said this, she said,
why the Letterman? Just because you guys had gone to that concert?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so. Yeah. And I said, and she said, don't you remember you met this guy? And I said, yeah. And I said, well, matter of fact, I actually have this card in my wallet, and there was nothing left of the card.
Yeah, 3 years later.
Anyway, she says, why don't you call him right then and there? Why don't you call him? And we just finished a pizza playing cards or whatever we were doing, and I said, really? She said, of course, use my phone. You know there was no mobile phones then.
Yeah, right.
And literally I picked up the phone, and Vince Morton answered the phone at his house in Los Angeles. And I said to him, and I lied. I said, actually, I don't know if you remember me. It was a few years ago. And he said, oh, I think I sort of do. And I said, yeah, Vince, look, you know, I was just wondering, I just graduated high school. And I'm looking for a job. And I was wondering if I could have an audition with the Letterman. Hello, you know? And I said, I'm going to be in Los Angeles next week. And I wasn't, and I had no plans. I had no plans to be in Los Angeles. And he said to me, and my heart sank. He said, oh, I do remember you. Aren't you the guy that, you know, I think you gave me a business card. And I said, yeah. He said, well, look, we just hired a guitar player, you know, sadly enough, but keep in touch. And, one of those stories, you know?
Sure. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, that was that. And I said, but I'm going to be in Los Angeles. And he said, well, look, when are you coming? And I said, in about a week, possibly two.
And you were not.
And I was not. And he said, well, look, I'm in town until, because then I'm back on the road with the Letterman, and until was about 3 or 4 weeks away. And I said, okay, look, I'll let you know. Anyway, I booked a flight, and I called him again, and I said, you know, like, I'm going to be in town. And he asked me where I was going to stay. And I said, at the Hollywood Inn in Hollywood. And he said, so when you get to town, call me and I'll come pick you up, and I'd love to hear you play.
Wow.
I called him, and he came and picked me up, and I was so lonely. I was there for 7 days. I didn't know what to do. Yeah. I called people like Doc Severinsen when I was there, and all these people on the Tonight Show. I called recording studios trying to figure out how can I be a session guitarist
yeah.
in town. I did it all the wrong way. I had no idea. I was so young. Anyway, Vince picked me up, went and had this audition. It was a terrible audition, I thought, really. And I was really, really depressed after it. And I figured, oh, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to go back home. You know, I guess I'm going to Berkeley. Not that there was anything wrong with that, but I really wanted to get it happening, you know?
Right.
Anyway, 2 months later, Thanksgiving night, 2 months later, the phone rings. And this guy on the phone, his name was Art Silber. He was the road manager for the Letterman. And he said, we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Vince told us about you. He's no longer the musical director, but we are in desperate need of a guitar player. We understand you live in Erie and we're in Pittsburgh. And we're wondering if you could come down on the weekend because Tony Butala, the owner of the Letterman, one of the singers,
yeah,
would like to meet you and audition you because we understand Vince heard you and he's recommended you.
Wow.
And I said, who is this?
Yeah. It's Thanksgiving night. Yeah. I mean, someone's calling you and offering you. Yeah.
Because I told people that I did this, you know?
Yeah.
It was for real. And that weekend, 2 days later, because it was Thanksgiving on a Thursday night, on a Saturday morning, I drove down the worst snowstorm I ever remember in my life. Drove all the way down to Pittsburgh, met the guys, had an audition. Vince wasn't there. He was no longer with the band. I got the gig. I drove back to Erie, you know, actually on the Sunday night. And the plans were I'm hired and I start in January. I have to fly to LA in January. First tour is Japan, Hong Kong, Philippines for 2 months all up. Right. And then the first gig back in America is in Erie, Pennsylvania, at the Erie County Fieldhouse.
How about that? That's crazy.
It's insanity. Yeah.
I mean, that's unbelievable.
And truly that is what happened. And that was my launching pad. Now, Tony Butala, I still don't know the true answer to this, but I do know that Vince Morton and Tony knew each other. And Vince had told me at one point, and Vince is still alive, so I should, you know, re-ask him. I can't remember, but there was a recommendation that they knew each other and they heard about me from that. That's not how I got the gig. I think I got the gig from the audition. But these two ironic things that actually happened. My sister was so responsible for those two items. Huh?
There you go. All right. Yeah, it all comes funny. Full circle. And so, you know, people may be listening to this and thinking, okay, this guy, you know, he's 19, 20 years old. He goes to Pittsburgh, he gets this gig and everything. But what live experience have you had so far? So you mentioned Ron Seggie, who's also been on the podcast before. You played with him, Charles McCormish, Accents on Sound. You played with them. I don't know what that was. Do you know what that was?
I can't remember, but I did a lot of work in Erie with
you did
with bands like the Hayner Brothers and oh gosh, you know, just various things. You know, I mean, I had my own little jazz trio with Dave Kane on piano, and you know, I mean.
So that's what it was, mostly jazz stuff or like,
well,
not
yeah,
with
so
Ron.
With Ron, no. But yeah, I mean, it was sort of jazz stuff because, you know, that was happening. But and also, you know, I mean, I used to play with my dad. So as a youngster, I skipped this part, is that when my dad's partner got sick, I would have to go fill in the Erie International Airport or the Erie Manicore Club. And I was underage, you know, right?
Yeah.
Because of drinking laws, I don't know what 16 or 18 there, what it, you know, or it's 21 there.
It's
I think,
21.
You know?
Yeah, right, yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I was out there playing with my dad when his partner got sick at 15 years old.
Yeah. Okay.
So I would have to strap on this guitar and, you know, we had a white shirt and bow tie and a vest or whatever. And I had to stroll around table to table with my dad. It was so embarrassing. I remember it was, you know, watching all these romantic, beautiful people eating and, you know, and you know, we playing the songs, but that was great experience. You see, that was great experience.
How did you become the musical arranger for Ron Seggie? Because I mean, you were 18 years old when you were doing that. I mean,
I mean, he just sort of trusted me. I didn't know what I was doing, really.
Yeah, I mean, you guys were probably close in age, right? And I mean, there were a lot of people in the band.
You were Well, I mean, I did it, and I mean, I don't really know how qualified I was to be the arranger. It was an experimental process, I think.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. But it sort of worked. Yeah.
I think he's mentioned you and given you credit for that. And in articles I've read, you know, it talks about musical director Art Phillips is back with Ron Seggie and, you know, so, All right. Well,
I thank Ron for that. Yeah. Cause that was a real guiding light in terms of what I ended up doing in my career. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Were there other musicians in town that you admired or you would want to see, or you remember at that time, either through Osikis or Markhams or something like that? Or were you so focused on what you were doing?
I was pretty focused on what I was doing. I mean, I wasn't really in the rock scene a whole lot, which is strange. You know, I mean, there's a whole group of great Erie musicians that I only got to know later on, like, you know, Ron Guzik and, you know, Ed Pouton, who's now sadly passed away.
Right.
Very, very, very sad. Very, you know, sad. I used to talk to Ed on Facebook a lot. And yeah, so, I mean, it's really weird, you know, like Paula Holmes and people like that, you know.
Sure.
I don't know. I sort of missed all that. And I don't know how and why. And I'm quite sad about that, you know, because that was like the real foundation of Erie. And I was, you know, sort of out on the outskirts doing this, you know, solo, whatever it was, you know.
Right, right. Well,
I don't actually know.
And we should point out, like you said, I mean, the drinking age was 21 years old. A lot of those folks were playing in bars already. You weren't, you know, old enough to go. You know, so, I mean, unless you saw them at like Wyco's or stuff like that, you didn't get a chance to see some of those other bands.
No, well, I didn't, because I wasn't into dancing and I was, you know, very shy.
Right. Yeah. All those folks, Ronnie Guzik and Paula, they've all been on the EPS on the podcast before. And I'm super lucky to have them do those interviews. So let's talk about then. So it's 75. You are, like you said, you get this gig with the Letterman. It's January. You rehearse for a week. What happens?
Yeah, we go to LA. And I go to LA and we rehearse for, you know, a week, a place called Sound on Stage, I think is where we did it.
And are you the youngest guy in the band?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Really? I was. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And we flew to Japan and that's where we started our tour. And that was it. And, you know, I really, you know, that those next 2 years of my life, I think I was only with him for 2 years and I decided I wanted to leave. It could have been 2.5 years. It was a hard decision to actually leave the band, but I knew I wanted to go to LA because I started to meet a lot of great, great musicians in LA, like Tommy Tedesco and people like Tom Rotella and, you know, Dennis Budimir, really great guitar players, and Bob Bain. And we became acquaintances and, you know, I mean, they sort of liked me because I was, you know, young and up and coming. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I stayed with the Letterman for about 2 years or 2.5 years. And then I decided, okay, well, that was a really great experience, but I want to go to LA and really woodshed it, really learn, write the trade. And that was tough. It was really tough.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, being a session musician, you're one of thousands that, you know, are trying to make it. I mean, how do you even get in? You know, do you, like you said, just call studios? I mean, you made some connections. How does that work?
No, that concept didn't work like I thought it would. It worked when I was younger, when I went to LA for the first time. No, like that doesn't work that way at all. And really, I had, you know, I mean, I wasn't really quite even ready for this. Really, you know, it was a whole thing in itself. So, but I got, you know, I mean, a bit fortunate. I mean, a lot of luck came into this for me. You know, I mean, I was an okay player, but I wasn't a monster. You know, I mean, wasn't a monster player. You know. That's how I feel. But there was something that I had, I think, that actually did work. And I think it was a sensitivity, I think is the word that I would use in terms of the way that I play and the way that I think and the way I feel about, right, you know, sort of attacking the instrument or understanding what's going on. And I think that's what's got me through my career. I mean, I'm an okay player, you know, for sure. But I think a lot of it has to do with my focus and passion and determination and time of doing it. You know, I mean, the amount of time that I've done it now, it's all pretty natural to me. So, you know, I mean, I'm okay with it, you know?
Sure.
But where I really sort of ended up shining, I think more than anything, I mean, I think guitar is a big thing for me and I still play and I'm still passionate about it and all that. But I think what really happened for me was I realized, you know, in the late 70s, I mean, I got a little bit fortunate where I started writing songs, and I co-wrote songs with people like Minnie Riperton. Her last hit was a co-write that I did with her and her husband. And that really started to launch my thinking a little bit differently, that I wanted to see more longevity in terms of what I was going to do. Not, you know, I didn't want to be on the road forever. I didn't want to play guitar only for a living. I wanted to do other stuff, like write music, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really where things really started to open up for me. Again, a slight career change. And in LA, it's not easy to make a career change because you get stereotyped, you know? Mm. And people who thought I was, you know, with the guitarist that was looking for the session gigs, you know, which I, you know, I mean, I was okay. I was quite successful. I wasn't Larry Carlton, you know, getting those gigs, you know?
Is that a big leap? Do a lot of people say you can't become, you know, a composer from being a lead guitarist? I mean, is that unusual?
Well, yeah, it sort of was. You know, I was doing a lot of different things. I was, you know, I was a guitarist. I was doing arranging. I was doing some conducting. And then I started to score TV shows. It's like, you know, what am I doing? You know?
Yeah.
What am I doing? You know? And but I was doing all those things, you know? And it's really interesting. I mean, like, I'll just take a quick leap ahead. In 88, I decided to leave LA and I moved to Australia. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a couple of reasons I did that, which I'll go into later if you have time. But one of the things about Australia that really, really was great was that they allowed you to do all these different things in your career, to be diverse in your industry without anybody saying, well, hang on, you know, that doesn't work. In LA, it's a different story. It was anyway at the time.
Interesting. So you mentioned Barry Manilow and playing with him, and I think that kind of got you to Australia originally. Is that correct?
No. The first time I came to Australia was with a very famous European singer, Egyptian Greek singer named Demis Roussos.
Ah, I'm glad you said it because I couldn't figure out how to say it. I saw it on your bio. So
Demis Roussos, he was very famous. He had, you know, not in America. He wasn't big in America at all. But in all the Spanish-speaking countries and Australia and Europe, huge. I mean, like Julio Iglesias, he was, yeah?
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and I got the gig as musical director for Demis because Lenny Colton, who was a guitar player in L.A., a session player that was working with Helen Reddy, ended up getting another gig, and he couldn't do Demis's gigs anymore, and he called me and said, "You conduct, don't you?" I said, "Sure." Anyway, so I got the gig.
Yeah,
so I got the gig, and this big limo came to pick me up one day and drove me to Beverly Hills. And I, you know, rolled down the window, and this guy with a big caftan was standing on his huge property, and which was Demis Roussos in Beverly Hills, and we hit it off like that.
Wow.
Lovely guy, lovely singer. My mom and dad would have, you know, loved his voice because he was like the crooner, you know? Yeah, just an amazing singer. And I toured with him. And that was my first tour to Australia with him. And that was 1980.
How long did you stay with him?
Until I, just before Manilow. I was with Demis 81. Yep. About 2 years.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And
2 years.
So you're dabbling in this composing and portion of your career. Am I saying the right word? Is it arranging or is it composing? I mean, they're different.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's different. I mean, I was doing a lot of arranging in LA as well. I was doing stuff, you know, I mean, I have I co-wrote some songs on a show called The Love Boat, which of course you remember The Love Boat. Yeah?
Sure. Right.
And I was doing some arranging there for Joe Harnell for the show, cause he was the composer. And actually I was in the house band on camera on The Love Boat for about 32 episodes. So if the rule in Los Angeles with the AFM Local 47, which is the musicians union, is that anybody that is on camera performing has to be a real musician. And they have to pay you proper scale, right? So anyway, so in my early days in LA, I met this wonderful guy named Johnny Oliver, who was a contractor. We called these people contractors. And he would hire musicians for sessions, and he would also hire musicians to do something called sidelining. And on the Love Boat, they had a band all the time, of course, right? Well, mm-hmm. I was in that band. I had an afro, and I had a red guitar, and I did 32 episodes over 2 years, probably, you know, during 76, 77.
Okay. And I'm looking at you now. You don't have curly hair at all. I mean, no. Did you have a real afro or?
No, yeah. Well, no, it was permed. I don't know. It was the thing to do.
Oh, it wasn't a wig or anything that they put on you to look that way. It was.
No. It was my
you
hair.
And Dan McNamara both had afros back in the 70s. I've seen the pictures. Yeah.
It was something we did. Who knows why? You know,
all right.
I think it was like the Mod Squad guys. Or
absolutely. Something. Yeah. You were Link. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I gotcha.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. That's right. So was that a regular gig? I mean, you did a bunch of those episodes.
I didn't like doing it. I mean, when Johnny would call me and say, "All right, are you free, you know, on Thursday, Friday, because we need you?" I said, he said, "Mate, you got to do it." Well, of course, he didn't say mate. I'm in Australia. He said, "All right, you got to do it. You know, what else you doing? You know, I said, well, you know, I'm waiting for a recording session." He said, "Well, this is just like a recording session. Come and do it." You know, anyway, I would do it. And right, the call would be for 5:00 a.m. You know, and we'd get to Fox Studios in Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles, and you know, we sit there, and sometimes I never even got to your scene, and you sit there all day. Call back tomorrow, and you know, I can't come tomorrow. Well, yeah, you have to come back because you were in the other scene, and we have to have the same guys in the band. Sorry, it's like you know, I didn't like it. You know, yeah. I just didn't. And I was, I don't know what it was, you know, I used to get $110 or something for the day, whatever. I don't know what it was back then.
Right.
You know, but we would have lunch outside at the table at the cafe at Fox Studios on Pico Boulevard. And sure enough, almost every day next to us was the table of Charlie's Angels because their set was right next door.
Oh, well, that's not bad.
So we sit there with the girls from Charlie's Angels, and you know, we ended up talking to them. It was hilarious, really.
That was
and
worth the day. Yeah,
but I didn't like. I just didn't, you know, really want to do it. And now I look back and I think, what was wrong with me? Why didn't I want to do it? That was a great, great thing. And here in Australia, they play old episodes of The Love Boat, and I often see. Dude, oh my God, there I am. Yeah, yeah.
Now, during this time, you're not married or anything, right?
No.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. And so you're doing this, you're really living that life of when's my next gig, right? I mean, you don't know when it is unless you go on tour with someone.
Well, that's right. And we still live that way. See, you know, musicians are actually entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Really serious, interesting people. But we're actually entrepreneurs because we have a gig, but it's always short-lived. Everything always ends, you know?
Right.
Whether you're playing with a band or you're on tour with a big act or a small act, or whether you are scoring a TV show or a film or whatever, it always ends. Everything ends. There's nothing that ever goes on, you know? So I got used to that in my life, you know? And it's actually great. It's scary, but it's actually great.
You know? Yeah, keeps you on your toes, I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm never going to retire. I'm still looking for a gig, so to speak, you know? Really?
Who were you on tour with the longest?
Probably Manilow, I guess. Probably
you went
Manilow.
On a few tours with him, or?
I was his guitarist 83, 84, early part of 85. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And I've seen some videos of him during that time period. There's a lot. There's a big band on stage with him, right?
Yeah, and it was a great band. It was LA's top session players.
Really?
I happen to be in it, but I mean,
yeah.
You know, so I'm not saying I was one of them, but yeah, a great band. And actually, Barry and I are still very good friends, and we talk occasionally. So he's just a lovely guy, and he's still going. It's amazing.
Yeah,
I don't know how old he is. He's a bit older than me. But he's still going. It's just incredible. He's an incredible guy.
And one thing I wanted to ask you, you know, we're mentioning some of these folks that you played with, but I'm going to go all the way back to the Letterman, because the Letterman had been in the early 60s receive, you know, getting their, you know, biggest notoriety. And then you joined them in the 70s. Were you a fan of them or you were not?
No.
And no, not really. I wondered about, like, as a session musician, because we're talking a little bit about that as a profession, you know, you probably have to put aside, you know, what you like to play and listen to and realize this is a job, you know? So, I mean, was it difficult sometimes? Because I know the Letterman, you know, in the early 60s, they were playing 200 gigs a year. I mean, they played a lot. And
they did.
When you were with them, they were still pretty popular, right?
Oh, yeah. Huge. Especially in the Midwest, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. And we would, you know, I mean, they worked a lot.
Yeah.
They worked, you know, a whole lot. But I love their music because, you know, see, that sort of music, which we sort of call mom and pop's music or MRR music or whatever you call it, you know, it's got, there's a real, the songs are songs, you know, the songs are
people
really,
connect.
Yeah, they're just really well constructed, you know, I mean, they're just songs, you know, great lyrics and, you know, and great harmonic, you know, elements to everything. And it sort of fit my psyche in terms of, you know, my background, all the music I heard my dad playing and I played with my dad. And, you know, so it was in that era, not that my dad played that sort of music, you know, like of the Letterman, but it still was all that. So it worked really well for me because it came from the heart, you know?
Sure, sure. Yeah. Well, when did your career change to, I don't want to go on the road anymore, I want to do more of this composing, arranging, and then eventually producing, right? I mean, creating your own company.
Yeah. Well, probably when I started to co-write the TV show Santa Barbara, because there were six writers on that, and I happened to be one of them. And I was very, very fortunate. A great, great friend of mine, Dom Messenger, who is a music supervisor on a show called Guiding Light. What show was it? Was it Guiding Light or Days of Our Lives? Can't remember.
Soap opera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I think he did both. But I play guitar on a lot of his sessions on the Days of Our Lives. Sorry. Yeah. It was that show. So because I was playing, you know, a session or two a week, you know, for him as a guitarist, one day he said to me, "Aren't you a songwriter? Because you've done some stuff." I said, Yeah. And he said, "Have you ever written for TV?" And I said, "Oh, a little bit. I did some stuff for the Love Boat, for Joe Arnell." And he said, "Because look, there's a possibility, NBC have a new show coming up, and I'm not going to be able to handle it all, and I'm looking for a couple of people to help co-write. Would you be interested?" I said, "Of course." Sure enough, a few months later, it came up, and myself and Rick Rhodes, who's also now passed away, and Dom and a couple other guys, we all would co-write individually with Dominic, right? And we'd score the show. And I did that from as soon as I was doing that just before I got the gig with Manilow. Is that right? Or was it just after Manilow? Oh, I can't remember. It was that period, 84, 85. That really made me realize this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do. This is amazing because there's royalties but that's not why, because it's not about the money, but I mean, there is something about this too, but you see, it's just that the collaboratism of working with another creative element, a producer and a director.
Yeah.
As a composer is the most fulfilling thing in the world.
And so describe that to me. You're scoring a soap opera like Santa Barbara. Is it every episode you're creating the music that goes underneath, or it's not, is it the intro song or?
Yeah, not the intro because the song was written by somebody else. Actually, it's really funny, but the theme from Santa Barbara was actually written by Joe Harnell also, which is crazy. Yeah. Which had nothing to do with that connection now that I think about it. But no, with Santa Barbara, we created a library of music, right? Which is what I'm doing now for my own company. But we created a library of music for the show. Out of 26 episodes, we might score one or two really important episodes to image. But everything else was was pre-recorded stuff that would suit what the script was going to be.
So we know
what the script would be about 2 weeks ahead of time. Excuse me.
And we say, this is a good piece for this thing that's going on in the show or.
Exactly. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Dominic, who was a music supervisor, who was a co-writer as well, was the one responsible for putting the right music in the right scene.
Okay. You
know? That's how soap operas work because the turnaround time is so quick. They can't hire a composer to score. There's no time.
Right. I forgot about that because they're shooting them every day almost, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So they create their own library. And now that's what I do now for a living is I have a library of music because there's a thing called, production music libraries in the world. And I have one of them.
Okay.
It sort of stems from that. But then I've scored a lot of TV shows, a couple of films, but mostly TV shows that have been, you know, quite successful here, advertising stuff and things of that nature. But that collaboratism is something that I really love, working with a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, going on your website, you see all sorts of different, like you said, television, a lot of TV shows and everything. And, I mean, it's quite a resume. And tell us about when you started your company now.
Okay. Well, when I came to Australia in 88, I started to get work as a composer in advertising. That's how I survived.
Why did you come to Australia?
Well, I came to Australia because my first wife was Australian.
Okay.
Not that that's the only reason that I came here. We had met way back in the Demis Roussos tour back in 80, got married, lived in LA. And when our first daughter was born in 84, it was a few years later that I realized I didn't know if I really wanted her to grow up in Los Angeles because, you know,
sure.
I'm not from LA myself. There's no family there and not safe. And, you know, I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
So I kept coming back and forth to Australia, you know, with Barry Manilow, with an artist named John Rawls and a few other people. And I just started to get these Australian connections in that early part of that transition for me from 84 to 88 when I moved here. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting. LA is changing. LA did change at this time. Well, because of MIDI, mm-hmm. right? MIDI changed, you know, I mean, technology changed the face of the session musician and all that stuff. Things were going a little bit odd. I came off the road from Manilow every month because, you know, he only did a couple gigs a week. That was it. And we always had time off. And I'd come back to LA and I wouldn't get the work anymore because they called somebody else in the meantime. So I wasn't getting at the sessions at Universal anymore. And, you know, all right, okay, I'm sorry. I think you're on the E list now because, you know, we weren't sure when you're back in town. This is what goes on. And so I don't know, something started to change for me. And I thought, you know, wonder what's happening in Australia. And there was two other really good friends, really great musicians from LA, that had the same idea. One guy was a friend of mine named Leon Gehr, bass player. And he's just an amazing player. And Larry Mahobrek, who was a keyboard player, top session players in LA. And we all had the same idea because we all had this Australian inkling and we all moved at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And also Louis Shelton, who is a guitar player that produced all the big buzz Skag hits and all that, also came to Australia in the same weeks that we all did, the four of us. It was like, you know, what are we doing? We're leaving LA. We're coming to Australia. and we all did. And we all never looked back. It's been amazing.
Wow.
And funny enough, Chip, for some reason, when I moved to Australia, I started to get more work from LA as a composer.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Go figure.
And that's when you started your company there?
No. I was doing a lot of work for music library companies like FirstCom, Bruton Chapel out of the UK, and Five Alarm Music, which is a music production company out of LA. And I was living here and delivering all the stuff I was doing electronically before we could do it that way.
Right.
And that started me to realize that there's this other avenue besides television to score to called library music. And you think of library music like elevator music, but it's not. That's a whole different thing. Anyway, so I did about a decade and a half of scoring for all those other major companies, which are all now owned by Universal. And I have about 65 albums out now with them under library production music. I survive on that because it gets used all the time. And, so it's a trail of it's a long tail sort of trail of income, you know, broadcast income.
Is it like royalties that you get each time it's used? Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And about 10 years ago, I decided, well, I'm going to start my own library.
It's that recent. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Just 10 years ago. And I have 72 albums out. And I have representation across the globe, 85 countries, different sub-publisher in every region. Doing okay. You know, I mean, I spend a lot of money on new productions because I make sure I release 6 to 8 albums a year.
Okay.
You know.
So it's a quantity thing. You got to crank it out so that it's available.
Yeah, it's asset building, I suppose, you know. And yeah, I mean, I could stop producing and just live on the royalties, but I don't really want to do that because I want to keep asset building, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing. And just this year, well, you know, all of my foreign libraries that represent me have always said, you know, why don't you represent yourself in your own country? And I said, oh, I can't be bothered being a, you know, like a local distributor. No, I'm just a manufacturer. So I signed my catalog to another big company. It was BMG that actually represented me here in the Australasian territories. And, you know, I decided about 6 months ago, I planned ahead that, you know, I'm going to move the catalog away. I'm going to rep it myself. I just started doing that last month. This is crazy times for me.
Yeah.
And the only way that I could do it, if I was going to do this, because I planned 6 months ago, is that I'd have to have other libraries that I represented as well, because I wouldn't be big enough for all the TV networks to want to come to 101 to look for music choices, because I only have 75 albums, and that's only about 1,200 tracks. And that's just not enough. So I put the word out, and I'm now representing 15 other catalogs from overseas, different, you know, have a real variety of music, about 40,000 tracks.
Wow.
It's still small for a music distributor, but doing quite well after week 5. No, it's actually week 4.
Oh, wow. So it's new. Yeah.
Well, this little extension of 101,
right,
which is a new distributor, just brand new. And it's working well. It's starting to work well. You know, it's a bit scary, you know, but I like that. See, I like these risks.
Yeah, it seems like you are, you like the challenges. How old are you now, Art?
68.
So, I mean, you still got plenty of time to, I mean, do you play at all anymore? Go ahead.
Yeah, once in a while. I just played the other day just for the fun of it, you know, and I do it to keep the chops up because, you know, I mean, playing in the studio, which I do, you know, I mean, almost every day I play on something that I'm doing, but that's not the same as playing live, you know?
Right.
You know, I mean, as you know, it's just not, you know,
absolutely.
So, before I have a gig, and the last big gig that I had, I do once a year, I do this theater performance up the coast where they have Italian night and they call me to do a feature for 45 minutes of Italian songs, you know?
Yeah.
So it's all solo stuff. So I have to practice about a week before to get the calluses back up and the chops to make it fluent. Cause you can't, you know, punch in and fix the problem that happened a couple bars ago.
When you were back touring, were you ever married?
Yeah, okay. It was. During the Manilow time, yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, okay. Because I wonder, like, that's got to be difficult, you know? I mean, being gone for so long.
Yeah, but that tour was different because, you know, it was totally first class. I mean, you know, we flew on his private jet. A Manilow would only sing twice a week, maybe 3 concerts a week, and we'd have the rest of the time off and in the town, or else he'd fly us back. And, you know, so, yeah, and he was amazing to work for. You know, this guy, Manilow, you know, I have to say, you know, he's an amazing artist. You know, I mean, he may not be the world's greatest singer, you know. I mean, excuse me, Barry, for saying that, but he is. He's a fantastic singer. But he's a performer.
Yeah.
This guy knows how to get the best out of the band, no matter what, you know. And, you know, I mean, after playing Mandy or, you know, I can't smile without you, what, 80 times, you think, but you know, honestly,
he seriously, yeah,
every night you'd go up on stage and it was magic.
Yeah. That's what it I was going to ask you, like in some of those situations, like with him doing it so often, whether it's a Letterman or whoever you were touring with, after a while, magic. It's got to be rote, you know, it's got to be like, oh, we're going through this again. But with him, it was still.
Yeah. Well, no, it wasn't. I mean, even with the Letterman and with Demis or Minnie Riperton that I performed with, you know, it was always magic. These people who are those sort of, that's why they're artists, because they have this charisma that even, you know, the band who's probably so tired of playing that song for so many times.
Yeah.
It happens. You know, it's just, it clicks, and it's them. It's because of them, you know. And Manilow was the king at this. You know, he really knew how to get the best out of all of us. You know, it's great. It's great. You know,
there must be people over the years, and I always try to end episodes with folks like you with these types of questions. You know, favorite crazy story from the road, or just performing in general, anything that stands out, you know, that,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. What do you got?
Okay. Well, there's two things, right? One is not a funny story, but sort of is, you know, I'm performing with them and I haven't told the story a whole lot, but I can tell it now. It's okay. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people in the industry know about this story, right? It's 1980, and I'm touring with Demis Roussos. And I'm rehearsing with Demis Roussos before the first tour, which is in South America, before we came to Australia.
Okay.
And Demis had incredible orchestras on his records, huge sounding orchestras, right? And the band, we only had 11 people in the band, and we rehearsed for 6 weeks, right? And I remember my mom even came to LA during the time and she sat there and watched the rehearsals. It was great. But I used to have to wear headphones, and I wore headphones because I'm conducting to a click track, because the orchestra is in the headphones, on tape. And I'm conducting the band. We're all playing and singing. We had four background singers, and Demis, great, strong voice and a great band. And that's what he wanted to do. And it was magnificent. I mean, hello. Anyway, so we go on tour and we start in Mexico, and then we go play Chile, and then we go to wherever else. And then we go to Buenos Aires one night. And we perform at this big theater in Buenos Aires. And, you know, all of a sudden, this guy stood up in the audience and started screaming, and the whole audience was like getting really upset. I don't know what they were saying, because they're speaking in Spanish,
right?
Yelling and screaming and throwing stuff on stage, and then a whole riot happened. And we had to take our instruments down or off, and they took us down in the dressing rooms underneath the stage. They had to lock the doors because there was a huge riot in the theater, stomping like elephants above us. And, you know, seriously.
Yeah.
And they claimed that we were not performing. We were lying. It was fraud. Demis was not singing. The band is not performing. It was headlines in the paper, right? Demis Roussos commits fraud. This is horrible for Demis, right?
Holy cow. Guy. Yeah.
Poor guy. It was terrible. We were all scared to death. Anyway, so a big lawsuit's about to happen. And so Demis had to, we had to then hire the local symphony orchestra for the next series of concerts. All these people wanted their money back. It took us 7 days. I had to help write arrangements for the orchestra. And anyway, 7 days later, in the same theater, we have the same concert. All the people come back. Big thing, you know, like on the newspaper, Demis now is going to prove he can sing. It was bullshit because we were singing, you know.
Yeah.
But couldn't. Anyway, so we performed it. It was great. And the audience loved it. Standing ovation. Demis was so thankful to me and the whole band and everybody. And, you know, we got this together in 7 days. We got the full orchestra happening. At the end of the concert, the equivalent of the FBI or whatever you call it in, you know, Argentina come in, they lock all the doors, we're all under arrest.
What?
Because they didn't believe that we performed again. They didn't believe it. So they wanted this. It was this political thing. And we all got arrested. And we all got put in jail overnight. This is a true story. Yeah. Wow. I mean, I have headlines in the paper from Argentina about this, right? In handcuffs with them as going to jail overnight. Anyway.
Couldn't you have just played for them and said, hey, listen, we can do this right now?
Well, we did. But you see, there was this governmental thing happening in Argentina at the time. And I only found out this years and years later that they were looking for something, a superstar like that, to prove the strength of the local government. So the people could say, hey, you know, these people can't get away with this. Now, the only other band in the world that was doing anything like this was ELO, which was the Electric Light Orchestra. They were performing with tapes, you know? I mean, now everybody does, you know? I mean,
right.
But back then it didn't. So it was a horrible situation. And poor Demis, we got out of jail the next day, of course. But we couldn't perform. We had our passports taken away. There was a major lawsuit that happened there. We, you know, end up back in Los Angeles about 2 weeks later. Poor Demis had to go through this lawsuit. I was one of the key witnesses, and he ended up losing the case between himself and the promoter because of the loss, because they canceled all the rest of the concerts. And so that was a horrible situation. And I'll never forget, you know, the impact of that made on everybody, including poor Demis at the time. Yeah,
I bet that would be a memorable one for sure. You said there were two.
Yeah. Well, the next one was with Barry Manilow, which was an amazing thing. He performed, this is 83. And it took 6 months to organize this. They had to build a stage. Blenheim Castle in England, where the Duke of Marlborough lives, where Winston Churchill was born. They ended up creating a huge outside venue stage where we had 50,000 people come to the concert. And it was the first time that anybody ever performed in one of the royal sort of environments, right? And that was Manilow's concert, which is one of his most memorable ones. And it was an amazing experience because we all flew in, from London after the rehearsal on a helicopter and out on a helicopter. But when the people were out there, it was like Woodstock. It was like we couldn't see the end. And then when the lights went down and it was dusk, and Manilow walks on stage, all because they had flash cubes at the time. There's, you know, the old Instamatics.
Sure, yeah.
50,000 people with flash cubes. And it was like the most amazing sensation that you'd ever want to feel or see in your life. Yeah. So anyway, that's it. That's boring, but those are my two.
No, that's great. Yeah. No, I like asking those types of questions, especially for someone like you who has had an amazing career. So I appreciate you sharing all this. Have you come back to Erie? You played with the Letterman in Erie initially, like you said, that first gig. Did you ever play here again?
Not in Erie with anybody. I performed with Manilow, of course, in Cleveland and Pittsburgh and places like that, but not, I don't think in Erie, no.
Okay, because I know he played at the Fieldhouse twice, but once as an opener for Roberta Flack and then once on his own in the 70s, though. Yeah, so that was probably before you.
Yeah, that would have been, yeah. Yeah.
When was the last time you came back?
My 40th class year reunion 10 years ago.
That's right. Okay.
Because my 50th is this year in August, which I can't come to, but I'll say hello to all my Academy friends that we're in touch still, all of us. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Good. So,
anyway, Chip, thank you so much. What a great chat. I appreciate it.
Yeah. This was great. Thanks, Art. I appreciate you sharing all these stories with us.
Yeah, no problem. Okay.
All right. Hey, thanks for listening to season 6 of the Erie Music History Podcast. Just a reminder that I do host a music night on the first Tuesday of the month at the JPT Foundation's Events Center. It's on West 38th Street in the plaza that's next to Our Lady of Peace Church. Starts from 6 o'clock, goes till 9 o'clock, totally free. BYO everything. You can bring in alcohol, food. There's a great pizza shop next door. There's a Subway in the plaza. We, of course, have our house band, the Fabulous Leftovers. They play for an hour, and then usually we open it up to an open mic, or we have some other prearranged acts that follow the Leftovers from probably around 7:15, 7:20 till 9 o'clock. So check that out, first Tuesday of the month. Thank you to the JPT Foundation for continually supporting this podcast. I appreciate it. Also, thanks to my buddy Angelo Phillips, who also threw us a few bucks for helping support the podcast. I appreciate that. You can go to Patreon if you'd like to contribute, or there's a Venmo also. You can find all of the episodes right now on any of the platforms that you listen to podcasts on. I have not been updating the actual website for the podcast. But you can also see the photos of the people that I interview for each episode on Facebook under Erie Music History Podcast. All right. Thanks a lot.